On behalf of the Sabre Oral History Project, I'm Steve Jaremko. This is part one of three of my interview with Jim Cott, recorded at his home in Manchester Village, Vermont on September 10, 2019.
All right.
We can get started?
We can start.
All right. Today is September 10, 2019. On behalf of Sabre, the Society of American Baseball Research, we are interviewing Mr. Jim Cott from our Oral History Project. My name is Steve Jaremko, and I'm joined by Lindy Hessler. We are visiting with Mr. Cott in his home in Vermont. Mr. Cott was one of the most outstanding and durable baseball pitchers in Major League Baseball history. He was a left-handed pitcher who played for 25 years in the big leagues. Among pitchers, only Tommy John and Nolan Ryan have played more years. He is a member of the Four Decade Club and pitched during the administrations of seven U.S. presidents. In his 25 years, he played for the old Washington Senators, Minnesota Twins, Chicago White Sox, Philadelphia Phillies, New York Yankees, and the St. Louis Cardinals. Mr. Cott accumulated 283 victories with a lifetime ERA of 3.45. An outstanding fielder, Mr. Cott also earned 16 gold gloves for his excellence. He was a multi-game, 20-game winner with one particularly effective year in 1966 when he won 25 games. He was a three-time All-Star who pitched for the teams that went to the World Series, the 1965 Minnesota Twins and the 1982 St. Louis Cardinals. After his playing days, Mr. Cott joined the Cincinnati Reds pitching coach during the 1984-85 seasons. After his playing and coaching days, Mr. Cott developed a second award-winning career as one of the game's most well-informed, articulate, and respected baseball broadcasters. Welcome, Mr. Cott, to the Sabre Oral History Project.
Well, thank you. Happy to be a part of it.
The questions that we have is, first of all, what was your name at birth?
James Lee Cott.
And where and when were you born?
Zeeland, Michigan, November 7, 1938.
Can you tell us a little bit about your family?
I'm the youngest of four. Still have a sibling, Esther, who's 93 years old and still living. But I was basically grew up almost like an only child because I was 9 years younger than my brother. I guess you'd say I was an unexpected arrival. And Zeeland's a town of about 4,000 people. Equidistant between Detroit and Chicago. My dad was not a fan of either one. Not that he didn't like them, but he was a fan of Philadelphia Athletics. But, you know, it was such a great atmosphere to grow up in. I thought that every kid in America grew up like I did. You know, you ate three meals a day at home. Your dad went to work, came back. I could walk to school. And then when I eventually got into the world of professional baseball, I found out how fortunate I really was to have a family environment like that and a community environment. And I still get back there. As I showed you some pictures, I have a ballpark named for me there, a little league complex. So I get back there every year.
What sports did you enjoy playing as a child?
Well, basketball, of course, baseball was my first love. I wanted to be a big leaguer since I was 8 years old. They'd always say, oh, it's too bad. Jimmy loves baseball, but he's so small, because I was like the smallest kid. That's why Bobby Shantz was my hero, because I didn't really grow till later. But basketball probably was, because high school baseball didn't get a lot of publicity or exposure, but basketball was always a popular high school sport, and I was a good basketball player.
When you first started playing baseball, did you play in sandlot ball? Was it American Legion or Babe Ruth? And what positions did you play?
Actually, my first, what I'd say, organized ball was fast-pitch softball. And every little town in Michigan, southwest Michigan, had a town fast-pitch softball team. And, of course, later, when I looked back on my career, I found out how beneficial that was to my pitching arm, because that is such a natural action, like bowling. Bowling would be a great exercise for pitchers. So I played fast-pitch softball, but then we had like 8 kids in town. We'd go down to the high school athletic field and play the usual, you know, I'm the only left-hander, so you have to hit it to left field, you're out. And then my first real, it was pre-Little League, so my first real organized baseball was American Legion ball. And I was 14 or 15 years old by then.
And were you a pitcher, or did you play?
I was a pitcher in sandlot ball, and even in high school a little bit. I could play first base. I could play the outfield. I always considered myself a baseball player that just happened to turn out to be a pitcher.
Sure, because you're regarded as one of the all-time best-hitting pitchers of the game. So did you attend college after high school?
I went to 1 year of college, Hope College, in Holland, Michigan, which is now a D3 school. And our baseball season consisted of 12 games. A couple of them might be in snow flurries. my roommate, who was from Herkimer, New York, he pitched 6 and I pitched 6. So that was basically my college season. And I was scouted that year by Dick Winsick, who's since passed away, but he's in the Scouts Hall of Fame. He was scouting actually a pitcher who was pitching for Kalamazoo College. And I happened to be pitching against the pitcher from Kalamazoo and did well, won the game. So he said, well, I better go back and see that kid next week. And then I pitched against Elma. And, you know, I pitched 6 games, and I pitched 42 innings and won all 7 games. So,
wow.
So he... And I wasn't a hard thrower, you know. If they had the radar gun, then he probably wouldn't even looked at me. But then they invited me down to Chicago to try out for the Washington Senators, who were in town. And,
did they have the bonus baby at that time? Bonus
they
baby
did,
rule?
Which is kind of a cool story that I love to tell. Because if you got more than a $4,000 bonus, you went to the big league roster. Each team was allowed 2 of those, but they wanted to... Yeah, they wanted to not give the wealthy teams a chance to load up with 5 or 6 of them, so you would have had to sit on the bench for 2 years. It slowed down Sandy Koufax's career. And so Washington offers me $4,000, go to Superior, Nebraska, start my career, which is what I did. But in the meantime, Pete Melito, who was a scout for the White Sox, had been following me. And he heard I was going to sign, so he called my dad. You know, in those days in Zeeland, which is a very strict Reformed Church Dutch community, everything shut down on Sunday. Nobody played. I think it was Christy Mathewson who didn't pitch on Sunday.
Right.
So the scouts were worried that my parents weren't going to let me pitch on Sunday. So Pete Melito, he hears that I might sign. So he called my dad, and he said, I think I can get $25,000 for him from the White Sox. Because he said, I think he'll be in the big leagues in 2 years. Well, I didn't realize this till later in my career. My dad made $72 a week.
What did he do, by the way?
He worked in a hatchery right down the street from our home. And what he said to me, he said, and I didn't pay close attention to money. He said, Pete Melito just called, offered, said, thinks he can get you $25,000, then you'd have to go to the big leagues for 2 years. My dad followed that rule. Paul Pettit, Paul Giel, Jimmy Small, they were all busts. Even Ralph Lamenti, who signed with the Senators for $35,000, never developed. He said, we're going to take the 4 and go to the minor leagues and learn how to play the game the proper way. When I added it up, that was about 5 years' salary for my dad. You know, $25,000 in 1957 when he's making about $3,000 or $4,000 a year. But that was such a great decision, because I did go to the minor leagues and I pitched a full year for Jack McKeon, who was my playing manager, and I moved up, and these other guys that got the big money up front, they moved down. So that was a great decision.
So one of the questions, what did your family think of your decision to play professional baseball?
Oh, my dad was just probably the only time I saw my dad get emotional, because he was a tough disciplinarian. So, you know, we signed, and it wasn't, you know, any big. I knew he was happy, because my brother, who he loved dearly, just was a car guy, drove trucks, things like that. But being a baseball fan, you know, he was thrilled that I was going to play baseball. So my mother was taking me to the Grand Rapids Airport. in June of 57 to start my career. And he walked home from lunch and gave me a big hug, and he had tears coming down his chin. And I thought, wow. So I knew how much it meant to him. Yeah, that was back in 1957.
I can't imagine how proud they were of you.
Yeah, I contrast that to a lot of good friends I have. Bill Parcells, a football coach, would be one of them. He wanted to play baseball so badly, but his dad never thought baseball was a desirable career, so he kind of discouraged him from doing it, whereas my dad was just the opposite. You know, he was thrilled to have me play baseball.
Wow. So did you have any nicknames at this time when you first got in?
Well, Little Jim, and then when I got into Little Jim.
You're not
in high
Little
school.
Jim now.
And when I got into, when I signed and I went to my first spring training, they always pronounced my last name Cat.
Yeah.
Well, then they saw, like when we went through the, I modeled my pitching motion after Bobby Shantz. I used to hear Bob Elson announcing the games. On Sunday afternoon, I could listen to 8 games, 4 doubleheaders. White Sox, Cubs, Brewers were across the river, WTMJ, and the Tigers. So if Philadelphia would come in to play the White Sox and Bobby Shantz was pitching, I'd listen to the game. And Bob Elson would say, here's Bobby Shantz. Finishes on the balls of his feet, ready to move either way, always in position to field the ball. So I would go in the backyard off the garage with a tennis ball, and that's what I did. Well, now when I go to my first spring training, a couple cycles through pitching practice, fielding practice, the coach said, Walter Boom Boom Beck, he said, kid, you look just like Bobby Shantz. But then they pronounced my name Cat. So Chuck Stobbs, who was a veteran pitcher, and Truman Clevenger and Dick Hyde and guys like that, they would kid me. They said, oh, you got a brother Tomcat? You got a sister Bobcat? And then when they found out I was a good fielder, well, there was Harry the Cat Burkeen, and then Harvey the Kitten Haddix.
Haddix, yeah.
Both left-hand pitchers, sure. Both good fielders. So that's when the name became Kitty Cat, like with Haddix and Stobbs, and that's kind of stuck for the last 60 years. Actually, in college, Sweet Olson, who was, to me, an older guy, because I was 18, he was 22 when he had been in the service, he always called me Rawbone, because I was this, like, country strong-looking kid, but gangly, and I haven't filled out yet. Yeah.
Well, so you, I have the. You played minor leagues for the Superior Senators, the Missoula Timberjacks, Chattanooga Lookouts, and the Charleston Senators. So, do you have anything you'd like to mention about those teams?
Well, when I finished the season with the Superior team, which was an all rookie league, and it's a 60 game season, Ray Baker. Remember Floyd Baker, who coached in the big leagues for all? Played for the White Sox briefly, but it's Floyd's brother. But he, at the end of the season, he was sort of analyzing every one of us on our last road trip. And I'm sure he was saying things to make us feel good. But he said, kid, if you come up with a fastball, you got a chance. Now, can you imagine today, if you didn't have a fastball, you wouldn't even get signed. So I had a good curveball. I had control. That first year taught me a lot about, you know, for the first time in my life, I really got beat around. You come out of high school or college, you win every game, and then all of a sudden, whoa, these guys are pretty good. But, you know, I felt comfortable in that league. And then the next year was a big year because Jack McKeon was my playing manager.
And he was at Missoula?
Missoula, yeah. And he really, like nowadays when pitchers don't get to pitch out of jams because they're counting pitches and limiting their innings.
Yes.
He would, I'd have two men on in the sixth inning, for example, and he'd walk out to the mound, he'd spit a little tobacco juice in my shoe, and he'd say, hey, kid, figure out a way to get out of it. And, you know, some days you would, some days you wouldn't.
Yeah.
But I ended up pitching in Class C ball in a 125-game season. I pitched 245 innings. But backtrack that, when I started out, I actually could have pitched for Pete Suter in the Class B ball, but Jack said, oh, you ought to come play for me because I'm a catcher. And he was trying to build as good a team as he could. It was
sure,
Class C.
Sure.
So I went to the farm director, and he said, yeah, you can go play for McKeon. So I start out 1-4. And I thought, well, what did I do here? I mean, my next step is to go back to Class D ball where I've already been, or they're going to send me home. So Jack calls me and he said, kid, you're going to the big leagues. So he said, don't you worry. You're going to start every 4 days. Don't you worry about a thing. Well, I end up the year 16-9, lead the league and everything, and strikeouts and the whole deal, and the brass came down to watch me, and they kind of didn't know if I had enough stuff, and McKeon said, I'll bet you the best steak dinner you can find, this kid's going to the big leagues. So had I had another manager that wasn't that encouraging, he could have easily said, nah, kid's 1-4, I don't think he's going to make it. So that was a big influence on me. And then one of the advantages of signing with the Senators is they only had three left-handers in their organization. They had Chuck Stobbs, Hal Wudashik, and then they signed Ralph Lemeny, big bonus baby. So I had a chance to move up rather quickly. So I started the year in Chattanooga, did pretty well. I actually injured my shoulder a little, so when I went up to the big leagues, I really wasn't ready. I shouldn't have been there. With today's technology, I never would have been, because they check with the manager every day, almost to the point of what time he brushes teeth, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I said to Red Marion, you know, my arm doesn't feel right. I had struck out 19 to set a Southern Association record. Then I struck out the first four the next game. And then at the end of that second inning, I said, I don't know, there's something feels funny in my shoulder. So they said, I'll take 10 days off. So that's what you did. And then when I came back, I was throwing from down here. Well, the end was I had developed some kind of a fatty tumor back here. So I went up to the big league, started one game, and they could tell I was different. So they took that out, no big deal. And then
it was a surgical procedure. Then. So your first game, what do you recall about your first major league?
Well, I remember getting called up to face the White Sox, a lot of my buddies were White Sox fans. So my parents had just arrived in Chattanooga to see me. And I get the meeting with them, and I came out and I said, well, I'm not going to be pitching here. I got called up to the big leagues. So they turn around and they go to Chicago with my aunt and uncle. So I start the second game on
Your first game is a start.
And I think I got knocked. I gave up two or three earned runs, but it was obvious I wasn't pitching real well. But that was kind of a thrill for me, Comiskey Park, and that was the year the White Sox
won the pennant.
So, you know, the first two guys I faced were Louis Aparicio and Nellie Fox. And then in 60, I started the season with the Senators. I made the opening day and won actually my first game against Whitey Ford in Yankee Stadium. And then I wasn't ready to pitch in the big leagues. I knew that myself. But I was 21 years old. They didn't have depth there. So Cookie Lavagetto said to me one day, Don't you worry about anything. You're going to pitch everywhere. We're not going anywhere. So now I go out the next start and I get hammered. And he called me in the next day. He said, you know, we changed our mind. We're going to send you to Charleston, which was good. So I went down to Charleston for a couple months, and then I got called back up after that. So
while you were on the Senators, there was a few players I just wanted to get your just quick impressions of, just because they're not discussed a lot. One was Chuck Stobbs.
Chuck Stobbs was the one that I actually ended up taking his job because, you know, there was some coolness between the veterans and the young kids, and because they didn't have 4 or 5 year contracts, so if they got released, they're going to get 30 days pay and a ticket home. So when a kid like me came along, who was supposedly the top pitching prospect, that meant one of those guys going to lose their job. I mean he was okay. He was friendly to me later. We had a good relationship. And, of course, he's more famous for giving up that long home run to Mickey Mantle. But
565 feet.
Yeah. But Chuck was good to me. We had a good relationship in the end.
Roy Sievers?
Roy Sievers was, you know, I respected him so much. He was our best hitter and then got traded to Chicago rather soon after that. But in spring training, we would play inter-squad games, which was good for both pitchers and hitters, because two strikes, you're out. Three balls, you walk. So it forced you to throw the ball over the plate. So now I'm facing Roy Sievers, and I remember having his rookie card with the St. Louis Browns, you know, and I actually got him to pop up. So I said, well, maybe I can do it okay.
You can do this.
Yeah.
Pedro Ramos.
Pedro was the hot-blooded Cuban, flashy. You know, he used to come dressed in Western wear with fake pistols and stuff, rubber arm. And, you know, he's credited with giving up a lot of home runs. But actually what Pedro did for me is that first win in Yankee Stadium, I pitched seven innings. Jim Lemon hit a three-run homer off Whitey in the top of the eighth to put us ahead 5-4. I had given up four runs, but only like three hits and one earned run. And Pedro came in, pitched the last two innings, and saved the game.
Good.
Yeah.
Great. That's awesome. Elmer Vallo.
Elmer Vallo was, he's in that picture over there with the Philadelphia Athletics. And that was so cool because I remember listening to Philadelphia Athletics games when they played Detroit or Chicago. And here's Elmer Vallo, the only big leaguer from Czechoslovakia, and he runs into walls. And and then he joined us in Minnesota as a pinch hitter.
Yeah.
So I actually got to be his teammate.
That is awesome. Yeah. Now, the Twins moved in 1961. How did you feel about the team moving from Washington to Minnesota?
Well, we were very enthused about it. You know, we went to spring training, or a camp in the instructional league in the off season. So we went there one day with our Senators jerseys, and then they had a meeting and said, well, we're going to become the Minnesota Twins. And from what we knew of the Milwaukee move, which everybody, hey, a dealership will give you a car to use for the season,
and things like that.
So, no, we thought it was a positive move because the ballpark in Griffith Stadium is not in a good section. The team was a cellar-dwelling team, so we really thought this would be a positive move, and it was.
Yeah. You were one of the four starters, and this was under the first manager was Cookie Lavagetto.
Right.
And then in mid-season, he was replaced by Sam Mealy. Could you talk a little bit about Cookie Lavagetto and Sam Mealy as a comparison?
Well, Cookie, I always had a fondness for because as soon as I knew baseball history, so as soon as I got called up, I talked to him about the hit he got in the World Series in the late 40s, so I knew the history of him, and he really liked me, and he gave me an opportunity to pitch. But Cookie was a really laid-back guy, and our club wasn't doing well. We didn't have that good a team, but all of a sudden they thought that Sam Mealy, who was one of our coaches and well-respected, that he would be better, so they made that decision middle of 61. And then Sam was our manager through the middle of 67. So he and I bumped heads a little bit because they'd have scouting reports, you know, and they'd say, pitch this guy low, or you can't pitch him low. And I'd say, well, I'm a low ball pitcher, so I have to pitch him low. So, you know, in those days, pitchers didn't really take information from analytics. We figured out on our own what worked and what didn't.
Sure.
But then when Sam was in failing health, he passed away now maybe 2-3 years ago, but when he was in failing health in the 90s, I called him. We had a nice conversation, and he said, I'd love to have a picture from you. So I sent him an autographed picture saying, Sam, thank you for giving me the ball every 4 days, Jim Cott. And then his daughter called me back, put Sam on the phone. He said, it was a pleasure giving you the ball every 4 days.
Wow.
So that's what was good, you know, good about those early years is, you know, he had confidence in me and he let me pitch. That's all you can ask for.
Was Johnny Sain the pitching coach at that time?
Well, the pitching coach when I first joined was in Washington was Walter Boom Boom Beck.
Okay.
And then when we went to Minnesota, Eddie Lopat. And then Gordon Mulzberger. And then in 65, Johnny became available. And he had had success in New York. So here he comes in with a whole new philosophy of throwing more. And had a little. And he was so influential on my career. And then Hal Narragon was still a catcher early on, but now Hal was our coach, so they worked kind of in tandem. And they were so helpful to us. And then we win the pennant that year. And I give a lot of credit to Johnny because Mudcat won 21 games. So, and then later on when I got traded to Chicago or sold to Chicago, that's one of the reasons the White Sox picked me up is because Johnny was the coach. And then I went on there and I had two 20-game seasons under him.
Yeah, we'll get to that a little bit later. I wanted to talk about the quick pitch, so that's we'll save that. In 1962, you had a great year. You were 18-14 with a 3.14. So what happened between 61 and 62? You were also the it was your first Gold Glove, and I believe were you on the All-Star selection?
I was on the second. Yeah. That's the last year they had two All-Star teams.
Okay.
So I was on the second All-Star team. Actually, I think one of the reasons I got the Gold Glove was because I got my teeth knocked out that year. Part of, and
do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I was always in position to field the ball, and then they noticed that I was quick for my. See, when I was small in high school, I had the quickness, and then I grew, and I still had the quickness of a little man. So that's what really helped me in my fielding. But what happened in '61. I was 9-17, but I finally got a chance to start. And Eddie Lopat, I remember I was leading Kansas City 6-0, gave up back-to-back home runs to Darren Johnson and Joe Pignatano, and then I went in, threw strikes, got him on. I came in, and Eddie Lopat said, "Now you're getting there." He said, "You threw strikes and pitched a complete game." So the last part of '61 was sort of an apprenticeship. I didn't win a lot of games, but near the end of the year, I pitched some complete games. So in 62, I felt like I really was going to be part of the team. And Eddie had taught me a lot on how to use my curveball. And so, 62 was kind of a breakout year for me.
So at that time in your pitching arsenal, you had a curveball, which was pretty good. You always had good control. And then you had a fastball now.
That's it. We were a lot of us were two-pitch pitchers. They never encouraged us to throw the changeup then. I just wish, every time I see Johan Santana, I said, "Man, I wish I would have had your changeup." Mm-hmm. But we changed up on our curveball, and then for a changeup, we might just, you had a cruising speed with your fastball. And then sometime you'd try to give it a little extra, and then sometimes you'd take a little out. Sure. Whereas nowadays, everything is max effort, 98 miles an hour. So even though we only had two pitches, the number one priority was always to have control of your fastball and be able to change speeds on that. And then I had my speed with a curve with a couple of different speeds. So that was it.
Yeah. Some of the players at that time, I know that just to list, Harmon Killebrew started to become a real...
Yeah, Harmon was the face of our franchise, was a great friend. I spoke at his memorial service. He was such a gentleman. I think if you talk to, I know if you talk to Hank Aaron, who was at his memorial service, and the current living Hall of Famers, they would always say that Harmon is the classiest, most humble superstar Hall of Famer that there is. So he really was the face of our organization and kept everybody, but to try and not to act like a jerk, throw helmets or things like that. And then, as the years went on, we were teammates for 16 years. We became really good friends, and I had so much respect for Harm.
He was an awesome hitter and always dangerous in the lineup, but defensively, he seemed like he changed. He was in various positions. They'd have him at third or in the outfield or at first.
Harm was 5'11", 195, and built like a tank.
Yeah.
But yet, he was a quarterback in high school. When he was signed by the Senators, he was a second baseman. And then for us, he played third, he played first, he played the left field. So he didn't have the speed, but he had good hands and some agility, and speed was not a big factor in the game back then. And he was a pure power hitter. They rave nowadays, like Nelson Cruz from the Twins just hit 35 home runs 6 years in a row, first time. Well, Harmon hit over 40 home runs 8 years. And back when, you know, other than Maris in that kind of freaky year in 61 where he hit 61, nobody was hitting 50. Hank Aaron, the Hammer hit 40 a couple, but he never hit 50. So Harm was just...
Harman never did either.
Yeah, no. Yeah. But Harman was just that he had a very classic, balanced swing, and he was just a pure power hitter. He could hit those majestic fly balls.
Yeah.
The ball is carrying the way it is today, he might hit him 600 feet.
There's an old show called Home Run Derby.
Oh, I remember Mark Scott.
Yes, and yeah. You know, they compared a lot of the hitters, and oh, what a sweet swing he had.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
So, Camilo Pasquale.
Camilo's still living. He's down in Miami. I think he is probably pretty close to 90. And if you saw Camilo, like he's been at a couple of our reunions. He didn't come this year. I think he's obviously slowing down a bit. But if people saw him and the current players, they'd say, how did this guy pitch in the big leagues? You know, he's like 5'10", frail, but he had this big overhand curveball. And he still holds the record. My first opening day was 1960 when President Eisenhower threw out the first pitch. And he didn't go to the mound. He threw it out from the presidential box, and there was a big scrum to get the ball. Yeah. Clyde McCullough got the ball, out-wrestled me for it. It would be a cool ball to have. So now we're walking out to the bullpen at center, and the flag is blowing in. And we said, well, nobody's going to hit one out of here today. So Ted Williams, in his first at-bat, hits one 420 feet. But we win the game 10-1. And Camilo struck out 15 on opening day, complete game. That's still an opening day record.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Bob Allison.
Bob was probably the greatest looking athlete on our team. He was running back at Kansas. Played the game as hard as anybody. You know, and tragically had this ataxia, which is a hereditary disease. And he passed away when he was 60 years old.
Mm.
In those days, the pitchers and the position players were, you know, the pitcher stuck with the pitchers, and so we never had a close relationship off the field. We weren't enemies, we just didn't spend a lot of time together. And then I became president of the Alumni Association in 84, and Bob was a vice president. Then we were in a lot of meetings together, and then I was one of the first guys he called when they said, they think I have a drinking problem because he started slurring his words and losing his balance. And that was the onset of ataxia. Mm. And he had just retired from baseball. And, of course, in those days we had to work in the off season. And he had a long-time job in the off season with Coca-Cola, local deal. So he was collecting two pensions. He's out in Arizona, retired, and he's standing over the golf ball, and he just lost his balance, and he didn't know what was wrong. So they found out that it was ataxia, and attacks your something in your system doesn't reproduce itself, and then your lungs shut down. So, but he was rookie of the year, you know, just a great physical specimen, because in those days, without lifting weights, you didn't have nowadays, you know, There's over 150 players that are 6'3", 245 pounds. They're like football players. And he, of course, for me, he made that great catch in Game 2 of the World Series, which without that, I doubt we'd have won the game.
Mm. Okay. Earl Batty.
Earl was my first catcher, and just loved Earl. You know, great sense of humor, and was just a quiet presence behind the plate. Gold Glove winner. Had one of these snap throws from his knees. He wasn't fast, but he was agile. He actually tried out with the Globetrotters. But he just had this, you know, cool way about it. I'll never forget, I'm facing Mickey Mantle one time, and I fall behind 2-0. And Earl squats down, and he makes the sign of the cross, and he goes like this and puts his glove up. So, yeah, he was a really good influence on me in my early days.
Yeah. Ray Moore.
Ray Moore was a crusty old farm boy from Virginia, and he was tough on us rookies.
Oh yeah,
yeah. But like he came up to me one day. I'd given up a home run, and he comes over, looks over my shoulder, and sitting in front of my locker. He says, "Hey kid, how'd you hold that pitch you threw to Calavito? So I said, he said, don't hold it like that again.
Vic Power.
Vic was the one that brought the ball to me when I had my teeth knocked out, but he was probably the first rather flamboyant player. You know, as kids, we were all taught to catch a ball with two hands, and Vic was a one-handed player and kind of a what they called then a fancy Dan around first base. He's a gold glove first baseman and a good average hitter. We got in a few battles over Vic because in those days, like the Yankees would come in and they had Jim Coates, who was from Virginia. They didn't like black players in the league, so we knew Vic was going to get low-bridged, and he did a lot. You know, that happened, you know, even into the 60s. Yeah. Even in the, you know, in the 60s, Julio Becker, Lenny Green, Earl Batty, when Joe Fitzgerald, who was our bullpen catcher, bullpen coach, this was in spring training in 61, we actually stopped at the Sadler Hotel on the way to Tinker Field to pick them up because they couldn't stay in the same hotel with us.
Oh, hard to believe
it was in 61.
It is hard to believe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You think of that as happening back in the two centuries ago or something.
Yeah, right.
Tell us again that story about losing your teeth.
Well, Bubba Morton was a hitter for the Tigers. The grass was wet that night. If I wasn't in good position to field the ball, it probably would have hit me in the shoulder or something. But I was right there, and it skipped over my glove, and it bounced over to Rich Rollins, and he throws it to first base, but not in time. The first guy to the mound was Jim Bunning, and he saw me there with the, you know, blood coming out of my mouth, and Vic comes over with that baseball. He says, "You want to keep this for a souvenir?" It had my teeth fragments in it, which I kept for a long time, and then they fell out. But now I still have the ball. And then Herb, you remember Herb Score?
Oh, sure.
Herb Score got hit in the eye in '56
by Gil McDougall,
and I remember that story, and it really altered his career.
Yeah.
So this was on a Tuesday night. So they said to me, "Well, I guess we're going to have to put you on a disabled list." I said, "No, I don't want to do that. I had all these stitches in my mouth." But I said, "Get me a boxer's mouthpiece." So I had one of these rubber mouthpieces like that. I was living on milkshakes with raw eggs in them, liquid diet. I had all these stitches in my mouth. And when I would run, as they wanted pitchers to do, run your sprints, every time I hit the ground, it was tender. So I went to our pitching coach, Gordon Mossberger, and I said, "I can't run these sprints." I said, "Every time my feet hit the ground," he said, "What?" But I said, "I can pitch. I want to pitch Saturday afternoon in Cleveland."
Yeah.
Well, you can, but your legs are going to feel it without doing that running. Well, my next four starts are all complete games, and three of them are extra innings.
That is awesome.
And I said to Maltzy, "What's the story here? My legs feel great. What's this run it all about?"
You know, but thinking about the trials and stuff, the practices, did you guys play pepper in those days?
Oh, yeah.
Now, that's outlawed now, isn't it?
No, it's not outlawed. They just don't do it. Yeah, Pete Rose loved to do it. I want to backtrack a minute. The 62, those extra inning games. So now, one of them's in Baltimore, and I'm pitching against Robin Roberts.
Oh,
and he's on his way down. Of course, he's 38, and I'm 23. So we go to the 11th inning. We're both in the game. Man on first, one out, and I'm the hitter. So they think I'm Bunny, and I swing away and hit a triple. Then Vic squeezes me in, and I get him out in the 11th. We win 3-1. That's in 1962. Now, I get traded to the Phillies in 1976, and they have a press conference, and Robin Roberts is there. He walks in the door, and he looks at me. "If I knew you were hitting, I'd have thrown you a curveball." That's how the memories are, you know. The guy's memories are things that happened years ago.
There's a couple other guys I wanted to mention. We talked a little bit about Mudcat. Was there anything special that Mudcat brought to the team at that time?
Yeah, he brought a lot of energy. You know, he was an entertainer. He had a group called Mudcat and the Kittens. He was a singer. Actually, he sang at Harmon's memorial service.
Really?
And Johnny taught him this breaking ball. We call it a control curve. And just Mudcat just picked it up like that. He had great control. He won 20, 21 games that year when we went to the World Series. But Mudcat also was very sensitive to the racial discrimination that existed at that time. And a lot of the black and black Cuban players knew it, but they were hesitant to speak out about it. And Mudcat was always sensitive to that, that, you know, where are they dressing? Why do you, we're not going to sit in the back of the bus, things like, and we weren't offended by it. It was just he wanted to stick up for civil rights, really. Yeah, so he was always outspoken about that. But
That's a brave thing.
Yeah, he was a great teammate. When I won my 20th game in Chicago in 1960, 1-0 game, and he had a crown carved out of cardboard with Kitty Cat, 20-game winner, King of the Hill, and you know that I could wear. So yeah, we had a good relationship. Always have had.
Now we're moving into 65 and the World Series. Now there was it was Zoilo Versailles.
Yes.
If I pronounced that correctly.
Yeah.
So what can you tell us about Zoilo Versailles?
Well, Zoilo, we came up, we played in the minor leagues together, and Zoilo was very talented at shortstop. And in those days, shortstops like Aparicio was sort of the gold standard. They didn't hit a lot of home runs. They didn't have quite the range that Zoilo had or the speed. Now, Zoilo made 30-some errors that year he won the MVP. But he hit, I think, 17 home runs, and that's what made him stand out as a shortstop. Truth be told, we all felt like Tony Oliva should have been the MVP. And it would have been better for Zoilo's career, because when he won the MVP the next year, he felt like he had to be Harmon Killebrew. And he couldn't really relax and just be himself, and he never was the same player.
His career went in decline after that.
Yeah.
So you had a couple of relievers then, Al Worthington, Johnny Klipstein.
Yeah, Klipper was a really good buddy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and we roomed together for a while, and he was the one that early in 65, about a third of the way through the year, he said, you know, we got a good chance to win the pennant. You know, the Yankees had won the last five. So we're all, really? You think we can beat the Yankees? So he started pointing out the strengths we had on our team. And so he really made me believe it. And he was just a nice man to be around. He had that calm disposition. So even though we were different in age, you know, we became close. We spent a lot of time together. Al, of course, became our closer. And Al was sort of separated from our team because he was almost like having a Southern Baptist preacher on your own team. And he was a good influence on me, but he really almost forced that on other teammates where they became a little offended by it. But a sweet man, still living in Birmingham, Alabama. Oh. But he had what pitchers call today a cutter. Mm-hmm. That was his natural pitch.
How do you explain a cutter?
If a fastball was like this and a curveball was like that, a slider really then was what they call a cutter today. What they call a slider today is, you'll hear the term every now and then, he threw a Smith mixer. Well, they go like this and they don't break, and then they go over the wall. So the slider today really, for the most part, is a sloppy breaking ball for most pitchers. But the cutter was the original slider, where, like Mariano, where you stay behind the ball and it looks like a fastball, and then the last minute it just slides. Yes. Now they say it cuts. And so Al's fastball from here naturally had, we used to say it sails, like a sailor. But now they'll say it's a cutter. But he had that pitch, and he became our closer in those days. You know, relief closers were not that prevalent. It was, for a long time, relief pitchers were just pitchers that weren't good enough to be starters. Yeah, but Al was real important to us in those. In fact, in 66, Baltimore ran off and won that because of Frank Robinson's year, but Al got his fingers caught in a garage door in 66, and we missed him that whole series. And we had rainouts to make up. They either swept us or beat us 4 out of 5 and kind of put us out of the race. But If he were healthy, we may still have had a chance to, you know, to stay close to him. Who knows? But, you know, they deserved to win with the year Frank Robinson had. But he was an important part of our team, Al was.
So the World Series, let me ask you, is there any, did you feel a sense of more nervousness at the World Series than you would like the games in the regular season? Is there ever a time as a professional baseball pitcher that you have your sense of nervousness? Was there always like, this is my job, you know, explain if you could.
You know, actually, I wish I would have been more nervous. Because I think when the Yankees had won all the time, and all of a sudden we won and we got to the World Series, it was like, we've really accomplished something. So I don't think we had the same intensity in the World Series, because just being there was something special. And then, of course, we won the first two games, but we ran into Koufax and Drysdale, and we couldn't touch them. But no, I don't think I felt any additional nervousness. I think the more pressure right now that players go through is a division series. I think once you get to the World Series, you actually feel, well, hey, you know, a pitch here, a break here or there, one team's going to win, one team's going to lose, but it's quite an accomplishment just to get there.
So during the World Series, you faced Sandy Koufax three times. He had the luck, I guess, of doing that.
And well, I tell a cute story about that, which I told on Boston TV last week, and everybody got such a kick out of it. Everybody always, Parcells always has me tell that story. But Koufax didn't pitch game one because of the Jewish holiday, Yom Kippur. He pitched game two. Drysdale pitched game one. So we knocked Drysdale out of the box. So Walter Alston comes to the mound to get the ball, and Drysdale says, "Bet you wish I was Jewish, don't you?" So we scratched out a run off Sandy in the game two. They took him out for a pinch hitter. We were only leading 2-1. Drysdale pinch hit for him. And then we scored three more to go ahead 5-1, and then he shut us out in 5-7. So there he pitched 18. He pitched 24 innings, and he gave up one earned run. Wow. So that's pretty hard to beat.
There was a video I was watching the other day of you. It was the last out, I think, of the game, the second game you pitched.
That's it right there.
Oh, yeah, right there.
Shaking hands with Earl and Don Mincher.
They hit a shot. So I forget, who was the batter?
Dick Chuzewski.
Hit a shot for the last out of the game. He stood there like, punk, and that was it. It was amazing.
Trixie, we call it. When he coached for Sparky, he was still shaking his head when he'd see me. He said, "You're the only guy that could have caught that ball." I mean, you just hit it, and the glove was there, and bingo. But yeah, that was
It was amazing. So thank you for sharing that. So the change then of Johnny Sane was your pitching coach at that time, and then after the series, you had this amazing 1966 year where you won 25 games. And could you tell us, you know, what came together for you during that season?
Well, you know, Johnny was a great influence in '65. Really, I had some what they call bicep tendonitis. I had my shoulder bothered me a little bit, so I was long arming the ball, and I started 42 games that year, but I only finished 7. So I was pretty good for about 6 innings, and then my arm would just like lock up on me. I don't know. I think I still got like 260 innings in or something like that. But now the next year, because of my shoulder, Johnny said, "We got to, you know, nowadays they didn't say, let's take an MRI and do surgery. You just figured out, what am I going to do with it?
Yeah,
how can I pitch this way?" So he said, "We have to figure out a way now to pitch with a little more wrist action, a little more elbow action." So now in 66, I've got this little more wrist, a little more movement on my fastball. I got a sharper curve. And I was consistent with my control. And, you know, if I pitched average, we scored more runs, and if I pitched real well, we'd win 2-1. So it was just one of those years where everything came together. He had told me in spring training, he said, "If you map out the schedule, there's 25 weeks." He said, "Your goal ought to be to win one game a week. So you'll pitch 3 games every 2 weeks. If you can win 2 out of 3 in 1 week, So that was kind of your goal. And we had a good team. So that's really what I ended up. I had 41 starts, and 25 wins. So it was about...
You had 19 complete games.
Yeah. Well, see, we got a lot more decisions those days, too. Like one year I was 18 and 14 because relievers didn't get called on until you were one run behind. We didn't have setup men and closers. Right. Which nowadays, you know, if you got the lead after six, they'll relievers will come in. So, yeah, I had a lot. I had 38 decisions. Nobody has 38 decisions anymore.
No, that was one of the things we're going to talk about later. So in 67, Sam Mealy was fired, and they brought Cal Ermer in.
Right.
Was there any, how did that managerial change affect your...
Well, Sam, we felt, had changed that, I don't remember what our record was. I want to say 16 and 16. Was it worse? Was it? But we kind of had the attitude is that, well, when we won, it was Sam's doing, and when we lost, it was all ours. So there began to be a little division there.
Oh.
And he and Billy were very close.
Billy Martin.
Yeah, and then Hal and Johnny were over here, so there was a little divisiveness there also.
Hal Nargon was still coach.
Yeah, Hal and Johnny were still there. And and then, I mean, we just weren't playing as well. And they made the change. When did they make? This was 67, right?
67,
yeah.
Yes.
No, 66 we got through the year, but that's when Baltimore nosed us out. But and then 67 is when we started out kind of slow, and things were just different. There was some animosity between John and Billy. Everybody gravitated toward Johnny because he would take the infielders and he'd show them how to hold the ball, and they could make the ball spin, and they loved to do that. So they were one team. Johnny and or Billy and Sam were the other team. Of course, I was quite outspoken after that season. They wrote an article in the Minneapolis paper. I was very supportive of John. And basically, without naming names, I said they fired the wrong guys.
Yeah, so that didn't go over well with the new managers.
And then later, Calvin Griffith said, well, you're right, we should have kept Johnny.
Yeah.
But Billy was, a bad influence on Sam in terms of turning us against one another. And then Cal took over, and Cal was a nice guy, but he was a minor league manager, and he thought we were still high school kids, and he wanted all these rules. And, you know, you're not going to have guys that are in their 30s that have been in the big leagues for 10 years with all these kind of, you know, mostly our rule was, hey, show up, play hard on time, and show up on time, play hard, and that was it. So, and we still almost won the thing, yeah.
So at this time, you also got Rod Carew came to the Twins.
Yeah, he was a rookie that year. And when he took some batting practice with us the end of 66, we could tell then that he was going to be an exceptional hitter. And then, you know, he was, and he was rookie of the year there in 67. Yeah. Rodney was just one of those guys. Nowadays, if you see batting practice, every hitter's trying to hit it out of the park. When Rod took batting practice, you know how there'll be some pitchers in the outfield. He would try to, actually, he was playing pepper with every guy in the outfield. That's how he would take batting practice to hand-eye coordination.
You never see anybody choking up anymore.
No.
Everybody's trying
or
to.
Or bunt, you know.
Or bunt.
He would get a couple dozen bunt base hits a year.
Yeah. He always seemed to place that ball. So 1969, I think what we were going through, 68, you were 14 and 12, 294. You had a pretty good year.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 69, another 14-win season. And this was the first year of the divisions.
Yeah.
And Billy Martin was a manager. So how did things change with Billy Martin at the helm now as manager of the Twins?
Well, first of all, you back that up to 67.
Okay.
You know, the big day that Red Sox fans still talk about is because I hurt my arm that second day of the season. I went into September of 67, 9-13. And then I found some magic, and I pitched basically seven complete games in the month of September. I pitched 10 innings in one, 8 in another. We end up 16-13, but I had the Tommy John injury, which they didn't have the surgery then, so I had to come out of the game on Saturday. We were leading 1-0. Hawk Harrelson and Yaz still are complimentary. They say, if you didn't hurt your arm, we don't know if we'd have won that. So when you go to those 14-year, I came back the next year. I didn't have surgery, but I really didn't have the power that I had the years before. Yeah. But pitching for Billy, it's sort of a complex situation because I enjoyed being a starter because he would let you pitch until your arm fell off if it did. You know, he stuck with his starters. But he also liked to second-guess pitches. You know, well, why'd he throw a curveball there? So there was always bumping heads between the pitchers and the catchers and Billy. So, and then, of course, he had a little trouble telling the truth. So at the end of 69, Calvin Griffith just lost patience with him. Because Calvin, say, for example, come see me any day, but don't come between 2 and 3. That's I usually lay down, take a nap. 2:30, Billy knock on his door. Things like that. So it was a different experience. Billy was a coach for us.
Yes, he had a player.
Teammate of mine in 61. Hit a home run his first game there, which helped us win the game I pitched. And then a coach, then a manager. And then I played for again when he was a manager with the Yankees. So,
did you find, just not to jump ahead too much, but did you find your relationship with Billy Martin changed from the time when you were first a teammate and then as a coach, manager one, and then a manager for the Yankees?
No, you know, your relationship with Billy face-to-face was always good. But it's things that he did when we weren't face-to-face that usually would cause some chaos.
Oh,
so, yeah.
You know, when I first moved to Binghamton, Billy Martin lived in our area.
That's where he got in his accident.
He was in his accident. I think I was there for about a year when he had a fatal car accident.
Bill Reedy.
Yes. Yes, right.
Bill Reedy ran a bar right behind left field in Detroit. Yeah, and they were, when Billy managed there, they were good friends. Yeah, he was, I think there was some controversy over Billy was actually driving, but Bill Reedy, who survived, I think was testifying that he was actually the driver, so they could.
Right, so, yes, I think that's true.
But Billy,
his license was suspended, or Billy Martin's.
Yeah.
Yeah, I believe.
Yeah, if they could have locked him, if they could have put him in the dugout, let him manage the game, and then lock him in his room. You know, he was a great game manager. He really was. Carew stole home 7 times that year, and he just had a feel for managing the game, but he just couldn't control himself away from the field.
Wasn't there a confrontation he had with Dave Boswell?
Yeah. See, there's a case where the Lindell Sports Bar, which really was off limits, Alex Karras had been caught the football player associating with gamblers there, so nobody was supposed to go in there, but Billy and Boswell were in that night, and they both got into their cups a little bit, I think, and Billy challenged Bos to come outside, but when I saw Dave the next morning with his cheeks all out to here, he said Billy had a couple guys holding, which doesn't surprise me, because knowing Bos, who was 6'2", 215, one-on-one, Billy would have done that to him.
Billy was about 5'8", 5'9".
Yeah, yeah. But, boy, if social media was in effect.
By the way, do you mind if we keep going with this?
No, okay. What time is it?
It's 12:30.
Yeah, I'm good.
Okay,
I'm good.
Great.
Yeah, I got a 3 o'clock call, but I'm good for a little while longer.
Oh, awesome. Oh, that's great. Thank you.
Let us know.
Yeah,
okay.
Please let us know. Or if you need to, if you want to stop and take
a
break.
No, we're fine.
Okay, good. Thank you. Now I'll edit that out. So a couple of, I had one other, two other players of that era, Dean Chance and Ron Paranoski. Any thoughts on those players?
Yeah, Dino was unique. He came over from the Angels, big, strong country boy, right-hand pitcher. I mean, the year he had in 64 was unbelievable. He was, I think, 5-4 on the 1st of June, and he ended up the year 20-6, won the Cy Young Award. He had 11 shutouts, and 5 of them were 1-0. He beat me once in 11 innings, one of those shutouts. But you knew he had real unorthodox mechanics. And, you know, he didn't last that long before his arm broke down. The big game, of course, is in 67. He pitched so well against the Red Sox. And he was so looking forward to pitching that last game, because if we win the last game, we win. And my friend became my friend still is Jim Lomborg, who was my teammate in Philadelphia. Lonnie pitched that game, and the Red Sox won it 5-3. So that was a big disappointment. And I think shortly after that, Dino went to the Tigers with Dave Boswell.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then Ron was one of the few left-hand pitchers that was a closer in those days. He was on the team with Koufax and Drysdale, and of course they didn't need a closer that often with those guys, but had this big slow curve and sinking fastball and just was a tough guy on the mound and really had a good career as a closer. Fun guy to be around. That's where I first took up golf, and I used to play a lot of golf with Ronnie. He's still living down in Vero Beach.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He came over with John Roseboro?
Yeah.
So during this time, this particular, you know, when you were, like, say, 1966, who did you find were your toughest outs? People that, not necessarily Mickey Mantles or people like that, but who gave you the toughest time whenever you'd come up to bat?
Well, the noticeable one or two were Hall of Famers. That'd be Al Kaline and Brooks Robinson. Oh. But then the Red Sox had an outfielder. He later went to the Yankees, named Lou Clinton. Lou spelled L-U. Yeah. I think he was 15 for 23 off me in his career. I just could not figure out a way to get him out. And every pitcher has one of those, a guy that's not necessarily a big-name player, but I couldn't get him out.
That's funny. So then the 69 playoffs, how would you characterize the Twins, championships, the division series at that time?
Well, those first two games were still two of the best games ever since they've gone to the division play. We lost them both by one run. We had a one-run lead in the first game. I'm pretty sure it was the first. We had a one-run, both of them, actually. We had a one-run lead going to the ninth. Jim Perry pitched a great game, and we really thought that Billy would bring in Ron Paranoski to pitch the ninth. But he left Jim in, and I think Powell hit a home run to tie it.
Yes.
And then they won it with a sacrifice fly. George Mitterwald hit a home run foul by that much.
Wow.
In the 11th, I think, and I believe we lost that in
12. He was the Twins catcher.
Yeah, we might have lost that in 11 or 12. Wow. 4-3. And then the next game, Boswell is pitching 11 innings of one-run ball, and they get a runner on in the 12th, and they got him home with a squeeze bunt. Hmm. So two games that really a bounce here, a bounce there, and then game three, they blew us out. They had superior pitching, and with Frank Robinson there, they were really tough. Yeah.
Yeah. They had an incredible team during that time as well. So in 1970... looks like Bill Rigney took over for the Twins at that time. What was he like as a manager?
Rig was totally different. Most managers I played for were sort of throw the ball out and let you play. Mm-hmm. But Rig had teams in California that didn't have a lot of power, didn't have a solid roof. So he always wanted to make moves. And, that year, for example, if you go 1 year ahead of that, ahead 71, I'm 13-14.
13-14.
Might have been as good a year pitching as I had in 66. I think I had 15 complete games.
3.32 ERA.
Yeah. I had more games where I was leading by one run in the eighth inning, and it would be my turn to bat, and he'd pinch hit for me with Charlie Manuel. And I'd say, Rick, I'm okay, But it's just he wanted to make a move. And like I said, I think that year I could have easily been 22-14.
Wow.
Yeah. So he was a totally different manager. He nice guy, but he didn't last that long as a manager. Frank Corlissi came in.
Yeah, Frank Corlissi. He was one of the players, position players.
Yeah, he was a good friend of mine. Frank passed away last year. He's in that picture there. But Frank took over, and then I got traded shortly after that, so I didn't play for him for that long.
Well, you put together 14 win seasons in 68, 69, and 70.
Yes.
Yes, that's incredible. It's really steady and very consistent.
Well, but let me tell you something about those three. I took a $5,000 cut in salary every year. How about that?
That's bad.
Yeah. But in those days, see, after that 25-game season, and I got a nice raise, then what they judged you on was, well, we expect you to win 20 games. So and you had no arbitration, you had no defense, you couldn't say, well, I'm going to go to another team. They just had you. So I took a $5,000 cut, a four, and then when I was 10-2 in 72, yes, broke my wrist, then that would have been maybe my best year. Then I got really stubborn. And I got my contract back up there a little bit.
I remember that he when he was 10-2, you were 10-2 with a 2.06 ERA.
Yeah.
And I remember the newspaper article in Pittsburgh that I saw Jim Cott, you know, out for the season.
Yeah, I broke that navicular bone right there. It was the last year before the DH. I was hitting 290.
How did you break it?
Sliding into second. You know, now they wear these padded gloves. And just by instinct, when you slide into second, I was trying to break up a double play, your hand automatically goes down.
Oh, yeah.
And it probably hit a little hard, and I came back, and I pitched, I think, two more innings after that. But it kept puffing up right in there, and I couldn't hold the ball anymore. Wow. And it didn't hurt that much. It was just swollen. And then when they took an X-ray, they found out it was that navicular, and that's the bone that helps you do this.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
So they put it in a cast, and I was done for the year.
You mentioned Cal Griffith. What was it like to deal with him? Was he a...
He was always known as...
Parsimonious.
The tightest owner, and, you know, basically he had the players because we had no recourse. We didn't have arbitration. We didn't have a players' association in that time. So, you know, one example was... when I had the 17-11 year in 64, but we finished seventh,
mm-hmm.
and he didn't want to give me much of a raise, and so I said, well, you know, I can't help it. I mean, the team finished seventh, attendance was down, but I had a good year. That's what we get judged on. So I think I was making $27,000, and he didn't want to give me any raise, and he said, can you go out on Cedar Avenue right now, which was what the Metropolitan Stadium was in, can you go out on Cedar Avenue, find a job, pay you $27,000? I said, can you go out on Cedar Avenue right now, find a left-hand pitcher, win 18 games? So, but that's kind of the way
that
the banter
great.
Went.
Yeah.
But he was tough. And then later, when he sold the team and I was announcing games there, we really had some laughs over it.
Oh, did
yeah,
you?
Yeah, but, you know, that's the way the game was played then. I mean, from an ownership standpoint, they knew you couldn't go to another team, and you didn't have any arbitration, so you argued as best you could, but basically you paid whatever they gave you. Yeah.
So you said a lot of players had jobs in the off season. So what kind of jobs did you have in the off season?
Well, I started out. I had a job with a 500-watt radio station in Shakopee, Minnesota, doing high school sports. I was doing a post-game interview with Ray Scott. And
he was from Pittsburgh.
Yeah. The early years, I went to the Instructional League in the winter. So I was, that occupied 2 months of my time, and they paid you a little money to do that so you could make ends meet till spring training started.
Yeah.
But then in 64, I was doing an interview with Ray, who, you know, was the voice of the Packers.
Yes.
And he said, well, Jimmy, what do you think you'd like to do when your career's over? And I am, like, 24 years old. I'm not thinking about when my career's over. But
yeah.
I said, you know, what you guys do seems like it would be fun, this, you know, announcing. So a guy in Shakopee that owned the radio station hears that, and he gets a hold of the Twins, and the next thing you know, I'm... which was a fun job. So I was doing high school basketball, high school football, signing on in the morning, doing livestock reports.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's incredible.